Hi, buddy. My name's Charles Little, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is the first day of January, 1986. My home group is the 12 and 12 group in Tupelo, Mississippi. And my sponsor is a guy named Walt Walton. And I am grateful to be sober, and I'm grateful to be here with y'all this weekend. I want y'all to know what an honor I believe it is to be here this weekend. I consider it an honor any time I'm asked to do this. To me, it kind of signifies that, you know, somebody has at least noticed that I'm trying to work this program in my life, and I'm trying to practice these principles at least in some of my affairs. So I thank you for the privilege of participating in your meeting. I don't really know what's happened to me this weekend. Ever since my wife made her talk last night, I've gotten nervous. Man, I must have done this thing 300 times in the last 22 years. You know, I know what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like today. But I don't know. I guess Suzanne did such a great job last night, and I've been working with her for years now, and I just. Yeah, I just about got her perfected. We're going to go on the circuit here for this thing. Oh, I'll pay for that. I know I'm not a speaker. You know, I don't have any illusions about that. But I am a talker. And there is nothing that I enjoy talking about more than the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and what it's done for this drunk in my life. I am truly, truly a blessed individual, and I know that tonight. What I'm going to try to do is try to tell y'all in a general way what I used to be like, what happened to me, and what I'm like today. And believe me, you will want me to keep it in a general way. I promise you. Because there is nothing funny or cute about the way Charles Little drank whiskey. It's pretty tragic, really. But thank God we've learned to laugh at our past. You know, if I couldn't, I don't know whether I could face it or not. You know, our book says in God's hands our past is one of our greatest assets. And you know, I'm here tonight for two reasons. First reason is I learned a long, long time ago in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous by doing what I'm asked to do, I get to stay sober. And the second thing is that I might say something that would help somebody else stay sober. You know, I love to work with new people. I think I've got a little talent. I can work with new people. My first sponsor was a guy named Ted McClanahan. That probably won't mean anything except to me and my friend back there. We talked about it. I think he went to school with Ted back at Mississippi State. Ted got sober in 1979, and he had 7 years of sobriety when he died. Ted McClanahan was a student of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, he must have sponsored 15 people. And when I came into the program of Alcoholics, I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous on the fourth day of August, 1984. And that is August the 3rd was the last day I had a drink, I wish I could tell you that's my sobriety date, but it's not. I'll get around to explaining that hopefully in a little bit. I know it's confusing. It's not confusing to me. I screwed up my life so bad, it's not hard for me to believe I screwed up my recovery also. But I was, I can't get up here and make one of these talks without talking about my family. You know, I like to say I came from good stock. You know, I was raised by two of the finest people God has ever placed on the face of this earth, Furman and Erdeal Little. I've always thought my parents' names were kind of unique. You just don't meet too many Furmans and Erdeals in your lifetime, and y'all will never know how true that is. My family, you know, I hear people come up here, get behind these podiums, their fathers are drunk, their mothers are drunk, their brothers are drunk, the cat and the dogs are drunk. It ain't no wonder they're drunk. That was not the way it was for me. You know, I was not raised in an alcoholic home. I was raised by really good people. You know, and My mother was 59 years old when she died, and she had never had a drink of alcohol in her life. My father was 50 years old when he passed away, and if my father drank, I never knew. I never saw him drunk. I never saw him take a drink. He had no use for anybody who drank to excess. And I was taught about, you know, alcohol early on, you know. And, you know, the first time I'd ever been exposed to alcohol, I was out in my front yard, and I looked out across the field out there, and my neighbor was walking through the field out there, and he stumbled and fell. And he was my best friend's uncle. And I ran out there, and I picked him up, and I could smell the alcohol on him. He was drunk, you know. He was an alcoholic. And I picked him up, and I got him to the house, and they cleaned him up, took him on in the house, and I went home, and I remember thinking, how can anybody do that to themselves? You know, I'll never take a drink. You know? And, you know, I think I was probably 9 or 10 years old at the time. And, you know, I probably had as normal a childhood as anybody could possibly have. There's nothing in there that would, you know, warrant me to be an alcoholic. But I have always felt different. I have always had feelings going on inside of me that I didn't understand, you know. I was probably a candidate for therapy in the early 50s. But I could just see me running up to my daddy and said, "Daddy, I think I need some therapy." My daddy wore my therapy around his waist. It was a big leather belt. And believe me, I got plenty of therapy. But I didn't get as much as I probably deserved. If he'd have known everything I did, I'd have got a lot more. You know? But I came on up and, you know, we get in, I don't know if y'all were like I was. When I was new in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it seemed real important for me to discover why I'm an alcoholic. You know, I got to thinking about what was the earliest memory I ever had. And I was probably 1 or 2 years old, and I was walking down the sidewalk, and I had tears just streaming out of my eyes. We used to have this big Great Dane dog that used to walk around in our neighborhood, you know, and every time I saw that dog, he just absolutely scared me to death, and I started squalling, and I froze. I couldn't run. You know, I often wondered what that dog thought. You know, the dog was just walking by. A dog never did a thing to me. He probably said, "What's wrong with that crazy kid over there?" You know, and I just cried, and the dog had gone by, and I'd go, you know, but I've been paralyzed by fear all my life. I didn't know. I didn't know what it was. I had a best friend that lived about 3 or 4 houses down from me, and this guy really had some serious mental illness going on with him. We would play together all day long. I mean, just have the best. Two little kids having a good time. And just about the time it was time for me to go home, he would get an overpowering compulsion to push me out of his bedroom window backwards. What a weird kid, you know. And he'd tell me, and I said, "No, you can't do that." Well, he got a belt and started whooping me, you know. And I'd pull away from him, and I'd run home. And the next day, we'd play, have a great time. Get time for me to go home. He'd get his belt out, and he wants to push me out the bedroom window backwards. I said, "No." You know, it broke my neck, you know. And finally, I gave down a little bit. I said, "I'll let you push me out front." You know, I'm a compromiser, you know, so he pushed me out frontwards. You know, I hit the ground, took off running. You know, I was thinking about that story. I don't know how many years I'd been sober, and I was thinking, you know, that's a weird, weird, weird kid. You know, I wonder what was wrong with him. And then all of a sudden, the idea hit me. Dummy, you was the one that kept going down there every day, knowing he was going to do it. What was wrong with you? It's amazing how we can get one-track minds, you know, about what was going on. But I've always been a misfit. Back as far, long before I ever had a drink of alcohol. You know, I know that I got a whole lot more wrong with me than swallowing whiskey. I got what our book talks about, them grave emotional and mental disorders. I had those things long before. Thank God for whiskey. You know, whiskey probably saved my life. You know, if I hadn't have took a drink of whiskey, I'd have probably blew my brains out before I was 16 years old. because I didn't know. I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And when I was in the 10th grade, myself and three of my buddies got together. We told our parents we were going on a hunting trip, but it was a planned drunk from the start. We stopped by a place called Sonny's Dixie Drive-In and bought a case of beer between the four of us. And we went out to this camp house out there, and I drank two or three beers, and I don't know if I got drunk or not, but I acted like I got drunk. And I made a fool out of myself that night, you know. And the next morning we got up, thought we'd got away with it, and one of the kids that was with us, his father had a feeling something was going on, and he kind of snuck out there that night and took a look and saw what was going on. We were all drunk and hollering and we're just kids having a, you know, experimenting with life for the first time, you know. And he caught us, and we had to go back and tell our parents what we did. And I just knew my daddy was going to beat me half to death because he didn't hold with drinking. But I was getting on up big enough that I was just about too big for my father to whoop, you know. And, you know, he grounded me and worked me for a couple of years, you know. And I didn't drink anymore the whole time I was in high school. But, you know, I never forgot that feeling. You know, that feeling when alcohol went down inside of me, all those feelings that had been inside of me all my life just disappeared. And no longer did I not feel like I was, you know, I was part of the group. Hey, I felt like I ran the group, you know. I mean, it did something for me. I don't believe it does for everybody. And I took off with it. I took off with it. Now, I've been a nonconformist all my life, you know. And I absolutely despise authority. You know, I just can't stand anybody to tell me what to do. You know, I don't know why I'm that way. But I thank God I got tired paying the price of being a nonconformist, you know. But I didn't drink again until I was in college. And I have all something that's always bothered me. I have always wondered, you know, I've been accused of a lot of things in my lifetime. But one thing I've never been accused of, I've never been accused of being too smart. I've been accused of being a smart aleck and a smart mouth, but never too smart. And I've kind of always knew that about me. I've known I wasn't one of those people that was burdened with a great deal of intelligence. You know, I knew that, you know. But, you know, that's not necessarily a handicap in this program. You know, I've never known anybody that's too dumb to get this program. I've known a lot of people that's too smart. They try to read that white stuff in the book in there, you know, and try to figure out what Bill really meant, you know. Okay, y'all ever run up on them? They're going to tell you what Bill really meant. They're going to read the book and tell you. And you know, so I used to, why am I not smarter than I am? I finally figured it out. Heck, I never studied. It seemed a lot more complicated to me than that. I can remember the first day I started to school. I'm standing in my living room and I'm pleading with my mother, "Mama, please, please don't make me go to school, Mama. I don't want to go to school." Now, I don't know why I didn't want to go to school, but I had it in my mind I was not going to enjoy school. And you would have to know my mother to know the kind and loving way that she always treated me. She looked at me and she said, "Ray, son, you've got to go to school. You've got to get an education." By George, I showed her. I went 14 years and I did not learn a single thing that would benefit a human being whatsoever. I lied, cheated, and conned my way through 14 years of education. And when I got out on the other side, I was probably as ill-prepared to go out into life as a human being could possibly be. I don't know how I did it. I never read a book. There was always some girl sitting beside me that was more than willing to do a book report for me, that was more than willing to do my homework for me. And, you know, I can remember we was a senior in high school and we had a spelling test every Friday. And I can't spell cat, y'all. I mean, I'm the world's worst speller. Her name was Carolyn Burns, and she sat right in front of me. And I remember reaching up and punching her on the shoulder and saying, "Write bigger." write bigger. But y'all, I love sports. Football, baseball, basketball, track. Anything that ended in ball, I loved it. And I was really, really, well, I used to say I was really, I was a little better than average, I guess. If I ever had a goal in my life, the only goal I ever had, I wanted to play football for the University of Mississippi, the Ole Miss Rebels. And I just knew that they were going to offer me a scholarship as soon as I got out of high school. And I graduated high school in 1965. Ole Miss came down and took a look at me and said, "You're not big enough." That broke my heart. I put a hex on Ole Miss in 1965. Y'all, I've been trying to take it off for 35 years. I think we finally about to get it off. But a little college about 60 miles, a little junior college about 60 miles south of Columbus called East Mississippi Junior College offered me a scholarship. And y'all, my folks didn't have enough money to send me to college, nor it would have been a waste of money to send me anyway. You know, I wouldn't have studied. All I wanted to do was get out of school, get me a job, make me some money, and get out from under my dad's care and direction and start doing what I wanted to do. You know. But I delayed 2 years in that schooling and got me two more years. I can remember taking a speech class when I was in college. Getting up in front of people it absolutely scared me to death. I'm not good at it. I didn't want to do it. And this professor that taught the class was a graduate of Livingston over there. And I told him I was going over there and playing football, and I needed those credits. So he said, "Well, if you'll just meet my class, I'll see that you don't fail." And I was probably making a D, C, F. I was about to flunk out of school, you know. And it got down to our final exam. And, you know, the final exam, we had to do a 10-minute speech on any topic that we wanted to, any current event that was going on that day. And it got my turn to do my speech, and I got up in front of the class, and I made my little speech, and I got a standing ovation after it was over with. The professor came up to me, and he said, "That was one of the most powerful speeches I've ever heard in my life." He said, "You really believed in your topic." And y'all guess what my topic was? Why the United States of America shouldn't be involved in the war in Vietnam. Let me tell you, about a year later, my butt was heavily involved in the war in Vietnam. I guess the president didn't hear about my speech, how we shouldn't be over there. My sophomore year in college, I had a scholarship to go down to Livingston and a half scholarship to Delta State. My father and the coach had worked me out a scholarship. I had gone to Columbus that summer and got me a job at General Tire Corporation down there. It was a new company that had opened up in Columbus, and I was working 12 hours a day, 6 and 7 days a week, and I was having me a ball. I had more money than I had ever had in my life. I didn't have any time to spend any money, but I was young, and I was drinking, and I was courting, and I was working, and the summer just went by so fast, and it was time for me to start going back to school. And my father started looking for me, and I started dodging him. I knew what he wanted. I'd gotten word he was looking for me, and I said, "I ain't going back to school. I'm done with school. I'm going to do what I want." And he finally tracked me down over at my old alcoholic's uncle's house, and I was tired, and I was in the bed, and he come in there and started jumping on me and telling me what I was going to do. And I jumped up out of that bed, and I got up in his face, and I had my fist doubled up, and I looked him in the eye, and I said, "I got me a job. I don't need no more of your blanking money. You don't tell me what to do anymore, old man." And I was fixing to hit my father. And I thank God to this day I did not hit him. I don't know what stopped me. And my father just kind of dropped his head, and he turned around, and he walked out of my life. My father was the first person that I ever ran out of my life with my active alcoholism. He was nowhere near the last, but he was the first. And there never was much between me and my father after that. I got drafted and went to Vietnam, and I got back in 1970. I spent the entire year of 1969 in Vietnam. I got back in 70. When I was in Vietnam, my mother and father divorced. They stayed together to get two boys out of high school. Their divorce was not near as common back in the 50s as it is now. That people stayed together and got their kids grown at least. And they divorced when I was in Vietnam, and my father got lung cancer in 1972, and he died in 1973. And there never was a whole lot more between us after that episode I just told you about. And that's one of the things that neither one of my parents lived long enough to see me get sober. And I have an awful lot of regrets, but I've been to their grave, and I've made those amends, and I've made those I'm sorries, you know. And I'm making amends to my father and mother today by trying to be the kind of son they raised me to be. They installed in me a set of morals and a set of values that I never was able to get drunk enough to forget. I didn't live by them for 20 to 21 years of my life, but I never forgot them. I knew I wasn't living the way I was raised to live. You know, I became an animal out there. Y'all, I don't know how to describe my behavior. Probably all of y'all have seen the movie Forrest Gump. I was kind of a Lieutenant Dan with legs after I got back from Vietnam. I was dangerously antisocial. I was drinking whiskey. I was doing all the things that a drunk does. Now, y'all, I have an awful lot of violence in my story. Most of it I'm not going to share with y'all tonight for two reasons. The first reason is I've taken care of all that stuff in a fifth step. The second reason is I gave up trying to impress people with my ignorance. It takes two fools to fight. Nobody ever wins a fight, y'all. But I drank an awful lot of that fighting whiskey. I'd get drunk and my smart mouth would get to going and there'd be a fight break out and I was in it. I don't know how many fights I've been in, and I don't even like fighting. That's the strange thing about it. Now, you go down in Columbus and ask somebody about me and they say, yeah, he's a hoodlum and a thug. All he did was fight. And I did. I got barred from the Southern Air Club every Friday and Saturday night. About 11 o'clock at night, a fight would break out, and sure enough, I'd be in it. The people that owned it were good friends of mine. And Friday night, about 12 o'clock, they'd throw me out. They said, Charles, you're barred. Charles Little, don't you, Monk, don't you ever, I had a nickname. Everybody called me Monk. Monk, you ain't coming back in. Go home. You ain't coming back in. You're barred. 8:30 Saturday night, I walked right in the door, had a filth of vodka, a bag of ice, and a can of Hawaiian punch. I didn't buy nothing in there. I just, hey, Monk, you ain't coming in, you're barred. I'd start begging. Oh, man. And you know, ever how bad I messed up the night before would be that much I'd have to beg. They knew they were going to let me in. They were my friends, you know, but they'd make me beg to get back in, you know. They had a $3 cover charge I never paid. After I got through begging, they said, all right, go in, but don't you get in any trouble. Don't you start any trouble tonight. And they knew I was going to do it. I was part of the entertainment there, I believe. But, you know, as this thing, alcoholism, started progressing in my life, you know, I started paying the consequences of my drinking. You know, I used to say, you know, not all of my drinking was bad. I had some good times drinking, you know. They're kind of foolish as I look back on them now. I did some really foolish things, you know. I wish I'd have grown up a little sooner, but I'm grateful for every drink I took. You know, if I'd have took one less, I might not have been ready. And I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous on the fourth day of August, 1984. When the jail cell in West Point, Mississippi opened up on the fourth day of August, 1984, and I walked out, the destruction of Charles Little was complete. There wasn't a single solitary person left on the face of this earth that cared whether Charles Little was drunk or sober, dead or alive. And they didn't care where I went, just as long as it was away from them. And that's the condition I found myself in that day. I had been to two AA meetings in 1980. I was having some trouble with my, at that time, spouse, you know. And she had told me, "Charles, you're either going to have to quit drinking or we're going to have to separate." And I said, "I'll quit drinking." I never had a problem quitting drinking. My problem is I couldn't stop starting. I always went back to drinking, you know. And I've got a little tickle in my throat. But I went to that AA meeting tonight, and it was a speaker meeting. And the guy was standing up there doing what I'm doing tonight, and my spouse went with me. And when we got home after the meeting, she said, "Well, what do you think of the AA meeting?" And I said, "It sounds like a bunch of old drunks sitting around telling war stories to me." That was my attitude. And of course, you know how long I lasted. I went to one more, and I'd had two beers when I went in the door. And I didn't stay. I stayed about 15 seconds, and it took me 4 years to get back. And I was a little more willing when I got back. I threw my last drunk with my boss man. My boss came into town on the third day of August of 1984 to do my evaluation. I'm a salesman. Can y'all figure that? I sell cigarettes. I sold cigarettes for 30 years, and I'm a retired cigarette salesman. And I was good at it. I'm good at selling me. I know that. That's a God-given talent. You know, I can sell myself, you know. And I did a good job for about, so when I was sober. You know, we're good workers. If you can get us to the job, there was a lot of times, man, I was so sick I should have been in the hospital, but I went to work. You know, I did a good job if you could get me to the job, you know. And my boss was a great enabler. My boss left to drink whiskey and chase women. God, could you ask for a better boss? Could you ask for a better boss? And we went out that night and we got drunk. And you know, I got home that night. And I won't bother giving y'all the gory details of what happened that night. Y'all about know. I walked in my house and my wife hit me in the head with a telephone. And God, I wish she'd have knocked me out, but she didn't. And after the fight broke out, I left, and I made it about 2 miles up the road when I hit the ditch. And when I pulled my head out of the windshield of that pickup truck, I came out of what is to this day my last blackout. And blood was running down my face and my leg. I got bummed up, and I come out of that blackout, and I didn't know where I was. I didn't know what I was doing or anything else, but I knew that I was in a ditch, and I knew there was a house around, and I knew there was probably some help fixing to be on the way. Can y'all guess what the first thing I did when I came out of that blackout? I reached up and grabbed my ashtray, stuck it out the window, and dumped it. Any of y'all know why I did that? I had an ashtray full of roaches. I not only had an alcohol problem, I had a drug problem also. In 1969, I picked up a bad habit called marijuana. And I probably didn't draw a sober breath from the spring of 1969 until the first day of January 1986. I was either under the influence of alcohol or some other mood-altering substance. And when I came into AA in August of 1984, I had an honest desire to stop drinking. But I had no desire whatsoever to give up my pot. So I came in here and became one of those people who are great supporters of singleness of purpose. By God, we say, "Hey, we don't talk about drugs in here." I guarantee you, as much pot as I was smoking, I didn't want anybody to talking about it. Y'all, I tell you how sick I was. I'd get up in the morning, roll me a joint of marijuana, and smoke it and do my prayer and meditation. I said, pot made me more spiritual. I got closer to God. God, I was sick, y'all. I was absolutely sick. Y'all, I don't know if the marijuana maintenance program will work for you, but it did not work for me. I didn't get any better emotionally. Down in here, where I'd learned to talk the talk, but I didn't know how to walk the walk. And on the first day of August 1984, I went out in my backyard, dumped out my bag of pot, went down to the group, and picked up a white chip and started this program over. Now, I'm still a big supporter of singleness of purpose. I went to a meeting Monday that was a drug log, and I don't like drugs. I don't like to hear a drug log. I like, the only reason I tell it is so that if you're trying it, I hope I can save your life. Why I didn't drink again after that, I don't know. I really don't know, but I didn't. I didn't take another drink, but I wasn't sober either. I talked it over with my sponsor. He said, Charles, we deal with AA in here, but if it was me, I'd pick up a white chip. So I picked up a white chip and started over. I'm going to tell you something. I experienced something I hadn't experienced in a year and a half called emotional pain. And I'm going to tell you something. I started working this program. I did something I hadn't done in a year and a half. I got me a sponsor. And I started working those steps. And y'all, that pain, you know, the pain is a great motivator. It'll force you to do the things necessary to bring about the changes within me. My first sponsor was a guy named Ted McClanahan, and from January the 1st, 1986, until October the 1st, 1986, he helped me work the first 9 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and have that psychic change that we talk about in here, a spiritual awakening or whatever it was, to overcome my alcoholism and find a power greater than myself, which is God, whether I choose to call him God or not. You know, I know today God loves me because he's good, not because I'm good. Probably the greatest line of any book that I've ever read is God does not make too hard of terms with those that seek him. And I started seeking God in my life in 1986, and I found God. You know, you don't have to find God. God ain't lost. All I had to do was give up on me, and God came into my life. Y'all, I have one brother named Billy. He's a Baptist preacher. You know how when you're new and you pick up these things that are wrong, like dysfunctional family? I used to run around saying, yeah, I came from a dysfunctional family. That's why I'm an alcoholic. I just told you about my parents. I got one brother. He's a Baptist preacher. The only reason my family was dysfunctional is because I was in it, I promise you. Like they dropped me out of a spaceship in there, you know. My mother was the first person, bless her heart, to tell me the truth about me. I'd taken her uptown, and we were going back home, and she looked at me and she said, Ray, you're an alcoholic. And I'll never forget my response. I said, oh, Mama, I ain't no alcoholic. I can quit drinking anytime I want to. That was 7 or 8 years before I made the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mama died in 1983. She never got to see her baby boy get sober. She never did. Those are regrets that I have. You know, I've wasted an awful lot of my life out there doing the things we do when we drink alcohol. I guess I needed to do that. You know, they say that no mistakes in God's world. You know, I kind of look back on my life, and it's kind of divided into 3 different 20-year segments. First 20 years of my life, I really couldn't wait. I didn't think it would ever end. The next 20 years of my life, I spent trying to destroy myself and anybody else that's foolish enough to care about me. In the last 20 years, I've been trying to recover from a previous 20. I'm just about to get well down in here where I live. I've got more time sober than I did drunk. I passed that last year. I spent 21 years drinking whiskey, taking drugs. But I'm sober right now, 22 years. If I make it to January the 1st of this coming year, I'll have 23 years of continuous sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And y'all, what it's like today? Y'all heard my wife last night. Can y'all believe that's my wife? She's only got 6 months left. Y'all know that? We only going to be married 6 more months. I told her when she turned 40 I was going to trade her in on 220s. She did what y'all did. She laughed. She's been a blessing in my life. You know, Suzanne and I, we, about 9 years ago, we got married in Columbus, and Suzanne got sober in Columbus. Suzanne's sponsor, she was talking about Patsy. Patsy lost her sponsor in 1987, 2 weeks before I lost Ted. Jane Jackson was her sponsor. Jane died, and then Ted died 2 weeks later. And that left a big hole in our AA in Columbus. And Patsy and I just kind of clinged together. And I stayed over at her house. And I know what Suzanne's talking about when she talks about pulling that big glass down there and reading out of that big book. I stayed at her house sometimes to 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. We'd study that big book and eat cake. Gosh, and get sober together. We traveled. We went to all over the state of Mississippi to roundups. And 1987, Patsy lost her son, Arthur, to a drug overdose. And I thought it was going to kill her. I really did. But she went through that with grace and poise like I've never seen. Now, I know how bad that must have hurt her. She'd lose her baby boy. But we made it through it. And we probably started and killed more AA groups than Carter's Got Little Liver Pills. Yeah, we were looking for the perfect AA group. We were going to start the perfect AA group. Only one thing was wrong. We were in it. It couldn't be perfect. You know, but we had some fun, and we stayed sober, and we had a ball. And Suzanne came in, and, you know, I can remember I was over in the Delta when Suzanne came in. Yet she did have orange hair, y'all. I'm telling you, it was the funniest thing I ever seen. The guy I sponsored, I got home that Friday, and he called me up at night. He said, "Man, you got to see Patsy's new pigeon. She's a fox." I said, "Boy, I can't wait." You know, and I go running over to Patsy, and there's Suzanne. I think, okay. I wasn't really impressed. I like my women a little on the trashy side. That Suzanne does not have any trashy side to her, y'all. And she has been a blessing in my life. A blessing in my life. I can remember I was driving down the road one day and I thought, you know, what'll I do if I get home this afternoon and find a note on our table that says, "Charles, I've fallen in love with a 35-year-old newcomer and we've decided to run off together. I hope you have a good life." How would I react? Boy, I got that old sick feeling down in my stomach that I used to get. I think, well, let's get out the hounds, boys. We got to chase them down, find out what they're doing. And then I got another feeling. I wonder if she took the checkbook. And then I got one of those intuitive thoughts that we always get. And I said, "Charles, what is your AA program? Yeah, you do. What does it say you are? You ought to get down on your knees, boy, and thank God for every day she stayed with you. You don't own her. She stays with you because she loves you. She wants a 35-year-old newcomer. If that's what will make her happy, that's what she needs." I don't think that's ever going to happen. That woman loves me as much as my mother did, I believe. That's the only woman that's ever. And y'all, you will not believe how good our marriage is. We very seldom ever have a cross word. Yeah. I don't get in her program. She don't get in my program. You'll have a lot of problems there if you do. Y'all heard her talk last night. She's a whole lot better speaker than I am. You know, I'm a talker. And she's also going to be at the Old Timers down in Jackson in August of this year. She's making a talk down there. And We just got a good life. She talked about her parents, and we moved back up next to her parents and built a house, and we've been in Tupelo for the last 9 years. And I really didn't believe life could be this good. Her father, you know, it's great when your father-in-law is your best friend. That is a great situation to have. And we are totally different people. Jim Johnson is probably the smartest person I've ever known. He's a rocket scientist. He used to build rocket engines for NASA. There is nothing that man can't do. You know, I can't tighten a nut. You know, you give me a board, five nails and a hammer, and I'll bend three of those nails trying to drive it in there. Hey, our commode stops up. I say, Suzanne, call your daddy. You don't want me working on it. But we have a great time. I never will forget a couple of years, about 3 or 4 years ago, Jim called me up and he said, Charles, there's a truck in Verona. I said, they've got some fruit trees over there. So you want to go with me to get some fruit trees? I said, yeah, Jim, I'll ride over there with you. And we went over there and he bought 2 pear trees and 2 plum trees and a couple of more trees. And I bought some for myself and we took them back home. And you know, he will let me operate the shovel, y'all. I'm real good with the shovel, and I dug the holes, and he stuck the fruit trees down in there and started putting them back together, and he looked up at me and he said, Charles, you never planted any fruit trees before? And I started to say it, but I knew he wouldn't get it. I started to say, no, Jim, we didn't plant any fruit trees around them beer joints I stayed in all my life. He would not have understood. He wouldn't have got the joke, y'all. He wouldn't have got it. But we have a great time. We have a great time. Her mother, you know, first time Suzanne's mother saw me, she started crying. And I can't blame her. All she knew about me was I was an alcoholic. I'd been married and divorced 3 times. I had an 8-year-old little girl living with me that I was trying to raise. And I was, I was 20-something years older than her daughter. I guarantee you my resume didn't look good to join the family. I missed a great opportunity to be a part of a mighty good family. God has given me a chance to be part of another one. God in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a chance, and I thank God for that chance. I try to be a good member of that family. Anytime there's a family thing going on, we're going to have Thanksgiving at my house next week, and they'll all be there, and I will act like a decent human being. And I'm glad to have them. Yeah. We have fun together, y'all. And I would alter the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and people just like you. Y'all, I don't know if I've helped anybody up here tonight. I hope I have. I hope I've said something you can use. But if hadn't anybody told you today, I love you. I love you because I know the price you paid to be sitting in that seat. Alcoholics Anonymous has no dues or fees. We all pay our admission price. Some of us pay more than others. I love y'all. Thank y'all for having me.